Thank you. May it please the court. Brian Wong for plaintiff appellant, Ron Romanelli. This appeal presents two issues. The first issue is whether the district court abused its discretion by denying Mr. Romanelli's repeated requests for counsel, even though it should have been clear that Mr. Romanelli could not present a coherent case on his own. The second issue is whether Magistrate Judge Crocker abused his discretion when he allowed the defendants to impeach Mr. Romanelli with evidence of his prior felony convictions. I will begin with the first of these issues. Mr. Romanelli's underlying claim is that he received inadequate medical treatment while he was a pretrial detainee at the Columbia County Jail. Although the legal standard for deliberate indifference claims is well understood, in this particular case, marshaling the evidence required to satisfy that demanding standard was a task that Mr. Romanelli could not do on his own. Accordingly, the district court should have granted Mr. Romanelli's request for counsel, and its failure to do so in this case requires reversal of the judgment below. Mr. Romanelli satisfies both prongs of the Pruitt test. The first part of the Pruitt analysis requires the court to consider whether the district court abused its discretion. And what goes into that determination is whether the factual and legal complexity of the case overstripped the pro se plaintiff's ability to bring the case on his own. The second stage of the Pruitt analysis is whether this mistake by the district court resulted in prejudice. Now, prejudice is not a particularly demanding standard. All it requires is a reasonable likelihood that the result below would have been different if Mr. Romanelli had a lawyer. I think that the record in this case makes clear that Mr. Romanelli satisfies the first prong of the Pruitt test. This was a factually and legally complex case. It was not a typical failure to treat case such as Jackson or Johnson. Rather, it was a more complicated adequacy of treatment case, this court's case in Greeno. So it required the plaintiff, in order to have any reasonable prospect of success, in order to put on complex medical evidence. I think that another fact which makes this case...
What's the complex medical evidence?
Well, in order to satisfy the deliberate indifference standard, Mr. Romanelli needed to show first that he had an objectively serious medical condition.
I think that was... I mean, it was conceded that he had Crohn's disease, right?
Well, I think everyone understands...
The question was whether it was symptomatic to the degree that required greater treatment than the doctor at the prison or at the jail gave him.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
And that's a credibility question. He said he was symptomatic and he was complaining about it and exhibited the symptoms, and she said he wasn't.
Well, I think the credibility plays into it, but I think that that's also, even as to the objective prong, this is an instance where expert medical testimony could well have helped Mr. Romanelli. As the district court recognized, this is a case that even if the jury believed every word that came out of Mr. Romanelli's mouth, it could have chosen to believe the testimony of Dr. Cillian, who was a doctor and who could testify that in her belief, he did not infect a serious medical condition. So I don't think this is just merely a swearing contest. But I think that even if it did just come down to credibility, there are lots of ways that a lawyer could have helped. A lawyer could have secured a corroborating witness, such as his cellmates, Mr. Romanelli.
Why couldn't he do that?
Well, I think this case is a lot like this court's recent decision in the Santiago case. In the Santiago case, like Mr. Romanelli, Mr. Santiago was incarcerated throughout the entire pendency of both the events relevant to his own claim and throughout the course of discovery and trial. But he was also transferred to a different facility. I think Mr. Romanelli faced many of the same obstacles in terms of securing corroborating precipitant fact witnesses.
Well, you know who his cellmates were, right?
Well, I think there's evidence in the record that he did explain on multiple occasions that his cellmates could back him up in terms of the fact that he was sometimes he was bought up in pain, that he had frequent bowel movements. I think these are all facts which Mr. Romanelli was just left to testify to on his own.
But there was no problem of identifying witnesses. He knew who they were. And so that makes this different from Santiago.
Well, I think that it also bears noting that Columbia County Jail was a site where there were many pretrial detainees. So I think just by the nature of that, 3 months later, a year later, these people are scattered to the four corners of Wisconsin. They're either serving their sentences or they've been acquitted and they're at home. So I think that Mr. Romanelli had great difficulty finding corroborating witnesses. This was a point, in fact, that the defendants harped upon during the trial itself. They pointed out that if he really had these problems, why isn't anyone else here? And I think that this is an instance where, as in Santiago, having a lawyer could have helped Mr. Romanelli develop and investigate.
But there was nothing inhibiting him from identifying those people to the court and seeking the court's assistance in or the prison system's assistance, to the extent that these people were still in the state prison system in Wisconsin, in locating these individuals and arranging for them to be produced for depositions. I mean, the court was really accommodating and offered to be helpful in that regard, as most district courts are in this situation.
Well, I think in the first case, the record doesn't reflect that Mr. Romanelli knew their names of his cellmates. I think that he knew that he had cellmates who could back him up, but I don't think that we necessarily know that Mr. Romanelli sort of had their full names or their contact information.
That's obtainable by interrogatory.
Well, I mean, I think that going back to Santiago, however, I think you could probably say much the same thing. Mr. Santiago complained that he had difficulty identifying the prison guards who abused him. And in that case, this is presumably Mr. Santiago could also have tried to.
Well, that's a little different situation. It's one thing to ask your opponent to identify those who abused you. It's another thing to say, who was my cellmate on this date? That's just an easy administrative record inquiry, right?
I think the record does not reflect whether this would have been possible, but conceivably there could have been privacy concerns. For instance,
that's something the court can superintend.
Assuming this, I think, assumes a degree of sophistication on Mr. Romanelli's part, which he may not have had as a pro se litigant.
The court said that all of his court filings were really well done.
I think that even granting that characterization of his filings, I think that this court has recognized that the demands of litigation change throughout the entire process. It's one thing to survive a motion to dismiss, but it's another thing to conduct discovery, and it's another thing entirely to actually litigate the case before a jury. I think it bears noting that in this case, Mr. Romanelli's claim survived summary judgment, and he made his third request for counsel after summary judgment about a month before trial. I think that the circumstances reflect that the court should have realized that Mr. Romanelli could not meaningfully try this case to a jury. He didn't have expert medical testimony, which goes to the Greeno point. He had difficulties securing and corroborating fact witnesses, which goes to the Santiago point. And he also had difficulty just deposing defendants, and I think this goes to the Pruitt point.
Do you have any discernible limiting principle on the informa pauperis recruitment of pro bono counsel statute if we were to reverse in this case? If we were to reverse in this case and find an abuse of discretion, then every deliberate indifference case requires recruitment of counsel.
Well, I think that this case falls well within the heartland of cases where this court has said the appointment of counsel is appropriate. And I think a reversal in this case
It's not a matter of propriety. It's a matter of whether it was unreasonable, downright unreasonable for the court to say no.
Well, I don't think this would open the floodgates to requiring counsel in pretty much every case.
There every are a number case of deliberate indifference.
Well, I think this is a deliberate indifference case, which requires probing the defendant's state of mind. It also involves complex medical evidence.
That's tantamount to saying that every single case of deliberate indifference that involves, you know, a medical issue of any kind requires an expert testimony. And, you know, what we're saying then is that there's an obligation on the part of the private bar, on the part of the district court, to recruit private bar to assume the costs of this type of litigation.
Well,
there's no justification in the statute for that.
Well, I agree. I mean, I'm not advocating for a categorical principle that every case which involves medical treatment requires counsel. But in this case, it's an adequacy of treatment claim rather than failure to treat claim. So this is the distinction between the court's Greeno case and the court's Johnson case. This is not a case where the defendants are alleged just to ignore the problem entirely. This is a case which involved Mr. Romanelli presented with Crohn's disease. Everyone admits that he has Crohn's disease. But because the symptoms of Crohn's disease vary from person and from time to time, there's a question of sort of identifying Mr. Romanelli's particular constellation of symptoms and sort of matching that up against what the defendants actually did supply him in terms of medical care. And I think that this court is a very demanding standard for meeting that prong of the deliberate indifference test. It requires that the plaintiff show such a departure from accepted professional standards that the defendant's treatment options could not have represented a reasoned decision at all. And in this case, Mr. Romanelli, on his own, could not feasibly have established what those accepted professional standards were, much less show that the defendant's conduct amounted to a great departure from them. I think that this case is different in other respects as well. This case survived summary judgment, and it was on the eve of trial. So this is a case where the demands were foreseeably going to be much greater because he had to actually litigate this case to a jury. And finally, as in Santiago, this is a case where he was incarcerated throughout and, in fact, transferred to a different facility. The events in question took place at the Columbia County Jail. He was later transferred to the Sauk County Jail. And later, after he was convicted, he was transferred to the Green Bay Correction Institution. So I think you have a constellation of factors, all of which, in tandem, make the district court's decision an abuse of discretion in this particular case. I think with that,
rebuttal time now.
I will reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Martin DeVries, and I represent Dr. Dalia Sulian, a defendant in this case. We respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court findings on the appointment of counsel issue and on the evidence of convictions. As to the appointment of counsel, Section 1915E provides that the district court may request an attorney to represent a person who is unable to afford counsel. Plaintiff Romanelli filed 3 motions requesting the court to appoint an attorney. Judge Crabb dealt with each of these motions, analyzed the information presented to her at that point in time, and used her discretion. A brief factual background relating to the counsel issue. Without counsel, Plaintiff Romanelli successfully opposed motions for summary judgment. The case proceeded to trial before Magistrate Judge Crocker. The jury found that Mr. Romanelli's Crohn's disease did not constitute a serious medical condition during the time that he was at the Columbia County Jail. After trial, Magistrate Judge Crocker reviewed everything again in motions after verdict. As to the appointment of counsel issue, he stated in his order that he had no doubt that Mr. Romanelli was sufficiently intelligent and articulate and tenacious to adequately represent himself at the trial. The issue ultimately determined by the court, or by the jury, was that Mr. Romanelli was not experiencing acute Crohn's symptoms. Now, considering that a pro se litigant does not have a statutory or a constitutional right to an attorney, the issue here is whether Judge Crabb abused her discretion. Rather than second-guessing her pretrial decisions, this court needs to look at the information presented to Judge Crabb when she was required to predict how Mr. Romanelli would perform. The initial question is whether the plaintiff appeared competent to litigate or try the case himself. And I think what we look at here with Section 1915E1, there's different ways to go with this. Are we sliding toward a per se rule, or is it discretionary choice for the district court? The statute itself and the case law indicate that the trial judge has discretion. The Pruitt case, which sets forth the standard case-by-case assessment by the district judge of the trial difficulty and the general abilities, and the events at trial cannot be used to second-guess the district judge's reasonable pretrial decision, which I think we're having here. Each of Judge Crabb's decisions, she evaluated Mr. Romanelli's intellectual capacity and his performance to date. The first motion was within a month or so, maybe two or three months after the filing. Defendants hadn't had to respond yet. Motion was denied without prejudice. She left it clear in writing that this was an open issue. He could file again if he wanted to. He filed again in June of 2007. It was denied because the allegations in the complaint were comprehensible and literate, and the case was not overly difficult. The third motion was decided in February of 2008. After Judge Crabb had reviewed all the submissions relating to his successful opposition to the summary judgment motions, and the basis for this motion was that he was taking antidepressant medication, and Judge Crabb concluded that this allegation simply indicated that the purpose of the medication was to allow him to think and act rationally. This is not a situation where something severe happened and sudden. It was something that he had been diagnosed with previously. And I'd like to address a couple of points made by counsel. One of them is a claim that Mr. Romanelli was having trouble marshaling the evidence. He had all the evidence marshaled. He had all the medical records. He had all the reports. They were admitted into evidence. The Greeno case, that also is quite different from the case we have at hand. In Greeno, I believe the injury was a whole lot more severe. And also, Mr. Wong had indicated that Mr. Romanelli couldn't or needed to get his cellmates or something to that effect. This was not presented to Judge Crabb at all. He didn't say to Judge Crabb, "I can't find these roommates, I'm getting sandbagged." It's not like Santiago, the case that was just brought to the court's attention, where the plaintiff was attacked. He was pepper sprayed by a sergeant. An unidentified officer yanked on his handcuffs. An unknown doctor didn't treat him. He was placed in a cell with somebody who attacked him and then further refusals to treat him. He filed several motions seeking counsel. He specifically said, "I need help obtaining reports, medical records, camera footage, locating witnesses." He didn't even have all the parties, and the court indicated that this court indicated that there's possibly some sandbagging going on, which was not the case here. He had seven constitutional claims, and he didn't know the names of the defendants. To the contrary, here all the persons involved were here, and as the court indicated in Santiago, it was an unusual confluence of circumstances that brought Mr. Santiago there. In our case, well, if the district court did not abuse its discretion, the issue is over. In our case, Judge Crabb did not abuse her discretion. She analyzed everything presented to her. Now, if there was an abuse of discretion, the next element is, would counsel have made a difference to the point where the plaintiff could not obtain any sort of justice? And that's not the case here, because the first question answered by the jury was whether or not Mr. Romanelli presented a serious medical condition while he was at Columbia County Jail. The jury said no. This was based on his testimony. He said, "This is what happened. This is what was going through me at the time." And the medical people and the jail personnel said, "No, this is what we saw." And the jury decided that his Crohn's disease was not acute and active at that point in time. So there was no prejudice here, because
the medical personnel at the jail did not deny that he had Crohn's disease, but only that it wasn't active?
That's exactly correct. Yes. There was no evidence that the gist of it was he wanted more in his diet, more food, this and that, and they said he was gaining weight, not losing it. There was no evidence that he was under duress, and he didn't need any further treatment because he was not going through active Crohn's. And I know my time is up.
Thank you. Tien?
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the Court, my name is Attorney Jody Yen. I represent Sergeant Christopher Kuhl. The Court should find that there was no abuse of discretion with respect to either issue on appeal in this case. This case presents a straightforward claim based on the alleged denial of Mr. Romanelli's medical needs during a 2.5-month detention at Columbia County Jail in 2006. He claims that during this time, his Crohn's disease was active and he needed eyeglasses. It's important to clarify the applicable legal standard with respect to the motion for appointment of counsel. Pruitt provides that that legal standard is three-pronged. First, a litigant must prove that he has made reasonable efforts to locate counsel and that he has not been precluded from doing so. Second, given the legal and factual difficulties of that particular case, the court must ask, is this litigant capable of litigating these claims himself? Only if the answers to those two questions are no, to the second prong is no, on appeal does the court ask the question, was this particular litigant prejudiced by the decision not to appoint counsel? This case is legally simple. The law was set forth in Estelle v. Gamble 34 years ago. Mr. Romanelli demonstrated his awareness of the legal principles from the very beginning of this case. If this court looks to the amended complaint on page 11, Mr. Romanelli, in fact, cites Estelle v. Gamble and sets forth the applicable legal principles. In addition to that, in this particular case, the district court reminded Mr. Romanelli in writing on no less than 6 occasions what the legal principles were prior to his third motion for appointment of counsel and throughout the litigation process. The district court did that in an order denying his motion to proceed in forma pauperis, in an order denying the motion for appointment of counsel, in its order denying the second motion for appointment of counsel, in its pretrial order, its trial order, and its summary judgment decision in order. In each of those cases, the court reminded Mr. Romanelli of the simplicity of the legal arguments. And in fact, Mr. Romanelli survived summary judgment based on arguments related to those legal principles with respect to 2 of the defendants. With respect to the other 2 defendants, his motion for appointment of counsel, had it been granted, would have made no difference because the other 2 defendants were not personally involved in any sort of constitutional deprivation. In addition, the court verbally reminded Mr. Romanelli of the legal principles underlying his claims at the preliminary pretrial conference. The case is also factually simple. The question was, is his Crohn's disease active during this 2.5-month detention? He didn't begin voicing complaints regarding Crohn's disease for well over a month into his detention. With respect to his eyeglasses, his complaints were few and far between and very inconsistent with his behavior at the time, banging on cell doors, other things he was reprimanded for while at the jail. The relevant facts in this case spanned 2.5 months. In Greeno, the relevant facts and the relevant documents spanned years. So this case is distinguishable from Greeno on that particular point. And the 2.5-month time span makes this case factually simple as well. The documents that Mr. Romanelli needed to support his claims were also available. Mr. Romanelli had those documents. He entered those documents into evidence at trial. And his attempts to enter those documents into evidence were not thwarted by opposing counsel or by Magistrate Judge Crocker. We facilitated his ability to do that and relaxed the rules of evidence across the board for him. To the extent he needed additional documentation, Mr. Romanelli very early in the case generated written discovery requests, which included requests for admissions, requests for production of documents, written interrogatories, and he did this on multiple occasions during the months of March, April, and May of 2006, as well as June of 2006. So he demonstrated his ability to consistently ask for what he needed. The witnesses that were available to him included Mr. Romanelli himself. He was in the best position. He had personal knowledge of the symptoms he was experiencing and testified to those symptoms at trial. Other witnesses were also available at trial. Those witnesses included the only medical staff he came into contact with, Dr. Saleen and Nurse McFarlane, who was not named in this lawsuit but had a lot of contact with the plaintiff during the course of his stay at Columbia County Jail. Other witnesses included the mother of his children, his girlfriend, his mother or stepmother, his father. His father was actually in attendance at trial. Mr. Romanelli chose not to call his father as a witness.
You think it would have been prudent to have an expert witness testify on his behalf?
The choice was Mr. Romanelli's, and Mr. Romanelli chose not to have an expert testify. What he had to establish was a serious medical need, and he failed at establishing that at the outset. He could have done that by showing that he was experiencing a medical condition that was obvious to a layperson. Testimony at trial demonstrated that the symptoms that he was experiencing would have been obvious to a layperson. He testified he was experiencing those symptoms. Dr. Saleen testified that she assessed him fully and noted that he was not emaciated, he did not appear dehydrated, he did not appear weak. Another way of establishing a serious medical need would have been through expert testimony. Magistrate Crocker and Judge Crabb provided him with the opportunity to call an expert witness. In the preliminary pretrial order, they set forth the manner in which he could ask the court for assistance in soliciting expert testimony. The court offered its assistance in subpoenaing witnesses for depositions or for trial, and Mr. Romanelli chose not to take advantage of those opportunities in this particular case. And so what he has, the demonstrated ability going into each of these motions, is that he has proved himself to be able to articulate the claims. The court noted that he formulated coherent arguments, coherent motions requesting appointment of counsel, and the case was legally and factually straightforward in this particular case. Each of the court's decisions to deny the motion for appointment of counsel were reasonable, and the question for this court is not whether the decision was right. The question is whether it was reasonable given the facts in the record at the time. And I think that Judge Crabb took that obligation very seriously when she denied each of his motions for appointment of counsel. The court also did not abuse its discretion when it allowed evidence of his criminal convictions for impeachment purposes. Limiting instructions were provided. Magistrate Judge Crocker was directly responding to Mr. Romanelli's request, is this evidence going to prejudice me, when it made its determination, and it was after Mr. Romanelli opened the door on that particular issue that defense counsel asked the simple question regarding the fact of conviction, and it was for clarification purposes after he said, I was arrested, I was sentenced to 18 months for the sexual assault, and I was also involved in these 22 counts of issuing worthless checks, simply for clarification purposes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Wong? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Wong.
The defendants insist that this case was factually and legally straightforward, but insisting doesn't make it so. In this case, the demands of navigating the judicial system increase as one moves from summary judgment through trial. A second point, the defendants point out that Mr. Romanelli had access to his own medical records. That's true, but of course he didn't have access to corroborating fact witnesses, and he didn't have access to his own medical experts, both of which could have helped a great deal. I think the fact that he has personal knowledge of his own treatment doesn't distinguish this case from Santiago either, since in Santiago, of course, the plaintiff also knew that he had allegedly been abused. I think this case, Mr. Romanelli could not feasibly have won it without at least some medical expert there to say that the defendant's treatment fell beneath accepted professional standards. I think it's important to keep in mind the two steps of the Pruitt analysis. The first step is whether there's an abuse of discretion. And here, the defendants try to shore out the district court's erroneous decision by pointing out, well, it wouldn't have made a difference anyway. This case was decided on the objectively serious prong. But I think that certainly the district court was not entitled to prejudge the merits of the case at the time it resolved Mr. Romanelli's third request for counsel. And at that point, the district court had no way how this credibility determination would eventually be resolved. I think the defendants also overstate the standard necessary to establish prejudice. All that's required for prejudice is a reasonable likelihood that the decision would, that the outcome of the case below would have been different. Certainly, Mr. Romanelli does not have to prove that his case would have been a sure winner, especially, I think it's especially unfair because you're looking at this incomplete, defective presentation of the facts, precisely because Mr. Romanelli was proceeding pro se. If I could also just touch very briefly on the impeachment issue. I think it's striking that the defendants don't even attempt to point. We cited over about a dozen cases and treatises explaining why conviction for sexual assault is extremely prejudicial because it's sort of viscerally offensive conduct which could easily lead the jury astray, while it doesn't have very much probative value at all, since such offenses don't really bear that much on credibility. This is a point which the magistrate judge did not take into account. If you read the transcript, he did not actually engage in the balancing process required by 403. And I think this also ties into why having a lawyer would have helped Mr. Romanelli so much. A competent lawyer, any lawyer, would easily have moved in limine well before trial to exclude this extremely prejudicial evidence. I think Mr. Romanelli also appeared at trial in a jumpsuit. I think that this is another instance where a lawyer could easily have mitigated this avoidable prejudice. With that, I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Thanks to Mayor Braun taking the appointment. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.